A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a whole thing this week about memory leaks. Not the abstract, don't forget to free lecture, but the actual taxonomy of what breaks in real code bases and how you hunt it down before the OOM killer does it for you. He wants us to start with the anatomy, what a memory leak actually is at the OS level, versus what developers loosely call one. He thinks there are several distinct failure modes that all get lumped together, and he wants them teased apart. Genuine, unreachable allocation leaks in manually managed languages, the malloc without free, the ownership confusion across library boundaries. Then the logical leaks in garbage collected languages, where objects stay reachable but are never used again. The unbounded cache, the listener registered and never deregistered, the global registry that only ever grows, the closure that captures far more scope than anyone intended, heap fragmentation that looks like a leak in RSS but isn't, and the ones that aren't heap at all, file descriptors, sockets, threads, IMAP regions, child processes that never get reaped.
That last category alone is worth the price of admission. People see RSS climbing and assume heap, but I've seen a service brought down by a file descriptor leak that looked identical on a dashboard. Same upward slope.
He also wants the language-specific classics, Python reference cycles and the Endeldedubble tuple, plus C extension leaks the GC can't see, JavaScript-attached DOM nodes and closures holding on to old state, Java class loader leaks and thread locals in pooled threads, Go routines blocked forever on a channel nobody will ever write to, and Rust's DRC and ArchC cycles leaking safely, which is explicitly allowed.
It is. The Rust book says so right there in chapter 15. Memory leaks are memory safe, which sounds like a Zen koan until you've debugged one.
Then the detection half, which is what he really cares about. The actual workflow when you suspect a leak. How do you distinguish legitimate growth over time from unbounded growth that eventually kills the box? Real tooling, named and explained with how you invoke and read them. Valgrind, Massif, Address Sanitizer's Leak Sanitizer, HeapTrack, Jamalloc and tsmalloc Heap Profiling, Python's Trismalloc, ObjGraph, Memray, Guppy, Chrome DevTools Heap Snapshots, and the 3-snapshot comparison technique, JVM Tooling with JMap, and Eclipse MAT. And the retained size versus shallow size distinction goes prof heap and goroutine profiles. And continuous production profilers like Pyroscope or Parca, where you watch allocation flame graphs drift over days.
That's a lot of tools. But they each catch a different failure pattern, and no single one catches all of them. That's the thing people miss.
Then the OOM side, how Linux picks its victim. What OOMscore and OOMscore JAGE mean? What shows up in DMEAJ? How to read those logs forensically? The groups V2 and container angle, memory.max versus memory.high, memory.pressure, why a container gets killed at its limit while the host has gigabytes free, why exit code 37 tells you almost nothing on its own, early warning tooling, early OOM, system doomed, PSI-based alerting, how to wire Prometheus with C-Advisor or Node Exporter so you get paged on the slope of the curve rather than after the kill.
The slope. That's the whole game. A single snapshot hides the slope, and the slope is the whole story.
He finishes with the discipline side. Regression tests for leaks, SOAP testing, RAAI, and smart pointers, weak references, bounded caches, arena allocation. And he wants honest disagreement between us on whether just restart it nightly is pragmatic or an admission of defeat.
Oh, I have thoughts on that one. But let's start with the anatomy, because half the arguments about restarting come from not knowing which kind of leak you're dealing with.
Let's do it. So, what actually is a memory leak at the OS level?
At the kernel's view, it's almost nothing. The kernel doesn't know what a leak is, it knows pages. A process asks for virtual memory through Burkey or Map, the kernel hands over address space, and physical pages get faulted in when the process touches them. The kernel tracks RSS, resident set size, which is how many physical pages are actually backed by RAM right now. But whether the process still intends to use those pages, the kernel has no idea. That's entirely the allocator's problem, and the allocator only knows what the process told it. A leak, in the strict sense, is a block that was malloced and the pointer was lost. Nobody will ever call free on it. The allocator keeps it marked live, and the kernel keeps the pages hot, forever.
And that's the genuine unreachable allocation leak, the C classic.
Right. And it's not just, I forgot to call free. The nastier version is ownership confusion across library boundaries. You call into a C library that allocates and returns a pointer, and the documentation is ambiguous about whether you're supposed to free it or the library will. Or the library frees it internally on some code path but not others. Or the allocation happens in one shared object, and the free is expected to happen in another, but they were compiled against different allocators. Those bugs can survive for years because they only leak on error paths nobody tests.
And then there's a second category Daniel flagged, the logical leak in a garbage collected language.
Which is, in some ways, harder, because every byte is reachable. The GC is doing its job perfectly. The object graph says this is still in use, and the GC has no basis to disagree. The problem is that in use and should be in use are different things. The classic is the unbounded cache. You add items, you never evict, the cache grows until it eats the heap. A cache without eviction is a memory leak disguised as a feature.
That's a good line.
It's not mine, but it's right. The listener pattern is the same shape. You register a callback on an event bus and never deregister. The event bus holds a reference, so the object is reachable forever. Global registries, singletons with append-only collections, closures that capture a giant scope when they only needed one field, all the same failure pattern. The memory is reachable, the GC sees it as live, and your heap grows without bound. Leak Sanitizer and Valgrind are completely blind to this. They report zero leaks, because technically there are zero leaks.
So you've got a process whose RSS is climbing, and the leak detector says it's clean. That's a special kind of frustration.
And that's where you reach for heap profiling, not leak detection. You need to know what's accumulating, not what's orphaned.
The third category Daniel mentioned is fragmentation.
This one is underappreciated. Glibc's ptmalloc creates per-head red arenas to reduce contention. A handful of live objects can prevent an entire arena from being returned to the OS. The process has 45 megabytes of heap actually in use, but RSS is sitting at 1.3 gigabytes. It's not leaking. The allocator just can't give the memory back because the live objects are scattered across arenas, and there's no contiguous free region big enough to unmap.
So it draws a leak-shaped graph, but it's not a leak.
And the fix isn't find the bug. The fix is swap the allocator. Jmalloc or tsmalloc. There's a case study from April where swapping Glibc for Jmalloc cut production memory by 47% on a bursty async workload. No code change. Just the allocator.
And the fourth category, the non-EAP leaks.
File descriptors are the big one. Every open socket, every open file, every pipe, every EOL instance, they all consume kernel memory that doesn't show up in heap profiles at all. A process can have a perfectly flat heap and still grow its RSS through unreclaimed socket buffers. Threads are another. Each thread has a stack, typically 8 megabytes of virtual space, and if you're spawning threads and never joining them, that adds up. Memmap regions that never get munmapped. Child processes that never get reaped. They sit in zombie state consuming a PID and a slot in the process table, and if you leak enough of them, you can't fork anymore.
The zombie process one is sneaky because it doesn't bloat RSS much. It just exhausts a finite resource silently.
And then one day your cron jobs stop running because fork returns EAGAAA and nobody knows why.
Let's go through the language specifics. Start with Python.
Python's got two distinct problems that interact badly. The first is reference cycles. Two objects that reference each other, the GC, can handle those normally. The cycle detector finds them and collects them, unless one of them has a TDelZ finalizer. Then the GC refuses to collect the cycle because it can't determine a safe finalization order. Those objects sit in GC.garbage forever.
And the second problem?
C extensions. NumPy arrays, pandas. Data frames. They allocate memory through malloc at the C level, outside Python's GC visibility. If the Python wrapper object gets collected, but the underlying C allocation doesn't get freed, either because of a bug in the extension, or because the extension author expected you to call some cleanup method you didn't, you get a leak that trace malloc will never see.
Trace malloc only traces Python allocations.
Correct. Which is why Bloomberg built Memray. It traces both Python and native allocations, outputs flame graphs, and can show you that your Python memory leak is actually a C library allocating and never freeing. That's the first thing to check when trace malloc says everything is fine, but RSS keeps climbing.
JavaScript.
Detached DOM nodes. You remove an element from the DOM tree, but a JavaScript closure somewhere still holds a reference to it. The node can't be garbage collected. The three snapshot technique in Chrome DevTools is the standard way to find these. Take a heap snapshot, do some operations, take another snapshot, do more operations, take a third. Then, in the third snapshot summary view, filter to objects allocated between snapshots 1 and 2. Those objects should have been freed by snapshot 3. If they're still there, they're leaked.
And closures holding on to old state is the other JS classic.
A closure captures its entire scope, not just the variables it uses. If you have a closure inside a loop that references one small thing, but the loop body also had a giant array in scope, that array is captured too. Modern engines have gotten better at optimizing this. V8 does scope analysis to drop uncaptured variables. But it's not perfect, and in complex code, it's easy to accidentally retain far more than you meant to.
Java.
Class loader leaks are the JVM signature move. Every time you redeploy a web application, the application server creates a new class loader. If anything from the old class loader is still reachable, a thread local in a pooled thread, a static collection somewhere, a logging framework that cached a reference, the old class loader and every class it loaded can never be garbage collected. Metaspace grows without bound. Eclipse MAT is the tool here. You load the heap dump, run the leak suspects report, and it walks the dominator tree to show you which object is holding the class loader alive.
And the retain size versus shallow size distinction.
Shallow size is the object itself. Retain size is everything that would be freed if this object were collected. A hash map entry might have a shallow size of 40 bytes, but a retain size of 2 gigabytes because it's the only thing keeping a giant cache reachable. The dominator tree in MAT shows you exactly this. You walk up from the biggest retained set until you find the single object responsible.
Go.
Goroutines blocked forever on a channel nobody will ever write to. That's the one. You spin up a goroutine to handle a request. It tries to send on a channel. The receiver exited early. The send blocks forever. The goroutine never terminates. Its stack, which starts at 2 kilobytes but can grow to a gigabyte, stays allocated, and everything on that stack, every heap object it references, stays reachable. It's a GC route that never goes away. Pprof's goroutine profile shows you exactly how many goroutines are sitting at which line of code. If you see a number that only goes up, you've got a leak.
Go 1.26 added that experimental goroutine leak profile, right?
Yes, it uses GC reachability to identify goroutines blocked on primitives that are themselves unreachable, so a goroutine waiting on a channel that nothing else can possibly write to. It's still experimental. You enable it with gorexperiment equals goroutinelli profile, but it's a huge step forward for manually staring at goroutine stacks.
Rust.
RC and arc cycles. Rust explicitly documents that memory leaks are safe. An RC cycle where two nodes point to each other will never be dropped. The reference count never hits zero. The ownership system prevents use after free and double free, but it doesn't prevent never free. Weak references are the escape hatch. RC downgrade to weak, arc downgrade to weak, and the cycle can be broken. But it's opt-in. You have to know to do it.
So Rust gives you the tools to avoid leaks, but doesn't make it impossible to create them.
Which is the right trade-off for a systems language. If you need guaranteed leak freedom, you need a language with a tracing GC that can collect cycles. But Rust's position is, we'll prevent the dangerous memory bugs, and for leaks, we'll give you the tools and get out of your way.
Let's move to detection. Someone suspects a leak in production. What's the first step?
Confirm the trend. Don't look at a single RSS snapshot. Watch it over hours. if RSS climbs past where the workload should have settled, if it's still going up at hour 6 when the cache should be warm and the connection pool should be full, you've got something. The slope matters more than the absolute value. And you need to rule out the lookalikes before you start debugging. Is this actually a leak, or is it fragmentation? Is it a cache that's legitimately filling? Is it the GC heap not returning memory to the OS because the runtime decided not to? Misdiagnose this, and you'll tune an allocator for hours chasing a bug that's actually in your code.
And if it's a leak, the tool depends on the language.
For C and C++, the staging environment gets valgrind with leak check equals full. It classifies leaks as definitely lost or possibly lost with allocating call stacks. The problem is the overhead, 10 to 50 times slowdown. You can't run that in production. For CI, address sanitizer with detect a leaks equals 1 is about 2 times overhead, which is manageable. And heap track traces every allocation with stack traces and gives you a flame graph you can explore interactively. That's the workflow from the case study in March. Valgrind defined the leak category, ASON to narrow it down in CI, HeapTrack to visualize the allocation site.
And for production, Gemalloc profiling.
Gemalloc-prof enables heap profiling with far lower overhead than Valgrind. You set malloc conf equals prof colon true, and you can capture heap dumps from a live process. It won't tell you about reachable unbounded growth. It's still looking at what's allocated, not what's logically leaked, but for native leaks, it's the production save option.
Python's toolchain.
TraceMalloc is in the standard library since Python 3.4. You call TraceMalloc.start, let it run, take a snapshot, take another snapshot later, and call comparecto between them. It shows you the top allocations by file and line number, ranked by the difference. That's your first stop. If TraceMalloc doesn't show anything but RSS is climbing, you've got a C extension leak and you need memory. ObjeGraph is useful for reference cycle hunting. It can show you the back references to an object, the chain that's keeping it alive. And gc.debu. NCollectable will show you the object stuck in uncollectible cycles because of TDA.
The Chrome DevTools 3 snapshot technique you mentioned.
That's the gold standard for JavaScript in the browser. For Node.js, you can take heap snapshots programmatically with the V8 module, or use the --inspect flag and connect Chrome DevTools to a running Node process. Same technique applies. Take snapshots, diff them, find what's accumulating.
GVM.
jmap-dump:live, format equals b, file equals heap.hprof, and the process ID. That gives you a heap dump. Load it into Eclipse MAT. The leak suspects report automates most of the analysis. It identifies the largest accumulated objects, walks the dominator tree, and gives you a short list of suspects. The dominator tree is the key concept. It shows which objects, if removed, would free the most memory. You walk up from the biggest retained sets and you find the one hash map or thread local or class loader that's anchoring everything.
And go!
/http/pprf is built in. You expose /debug/pprf/heap/debug/pprf/goroutine. For the heap, you take a baseline profile, wait, take another, and run gotool prof-base baseline.pb.gz leak.pb.gz. That shows you the allocations that happened between the two snapshots. For goroutines, debug equals 1 gives you aggregated stacks. How many goroutines are at each call site? If you see a number that only goes up, you know where they're blocked. Debug equals 2 dumps every goroutine individually, but be careful. On a process with 100,000 goroutines, that's a stop-the-world pause you'll feel.
And the continuous profilers, Pyroscope, Parca.
These are always on. They sample at something like 100 Hz with about 1% overhead, store the profiles with timestamps, and let you query them over time ranges. The killer feature is differential profiling. You deploy, wait, and compare the flame graph from before the deploy to after. New allocations show up as a different color. Parca uses eBPF, so it doesn't need instrumentation. It profiles at the host level. If you've got a leak that takes 3 days to become visible, you can zoom out to a 72-hour window and watch the allocation flame graph drift. That's a completely different workflow from attach a debugger and hope.
Let's get to the OOM side, because that's usually how you find out you have a problem.
The OOM killer wakes up when the kernel can't satisfy an allocation. It runs badness on every process. The score is roughly RSS plus swap entries plus page table pages plus score aj scaled by total pages divided by 1,000. Highest score gets killed. Score adj ranges from minus 1,000, completely immune, to plus 1,000, guaranteed victim. Kernel threads and PID1 are never killed.
And the process whose allocation failed isn't necessarily the one that gets killed.
Almost never in practice. The allocation fails in process A. The OOM killer looks around, and process B has the highest score. Process B dies. Process A continues. This is how a leak in your web server gets your monitoring agent killed, exactly when you most want monitoring to be running.
Reading the DMESC output.
Four sections. First, the trigger line, which process's allocation failed. Second, the memory state dump, active anon, active file, slab reclaimable, free. If active file plus inactive file is near zero, the page cache is exhausted and the system is thrashing. If slab unreclaimable is dominating, you might have a kernel memory leak. Third, the task table. Every process with its RSS, anon RSS, file RS, page table bytes, and score adj. Fourth, the kill line. Which process was actually killed and its memory breakdown?
And the forensic reading. How do you work out which process was actually at fault?
You look at the task table and find the process with the highest RSS that has a less negative score adj than the victim. That's your likely culprit. The victim was just the biggest thing that wasn't protected. If your database has score, adj minus 500, and your web server has 0, the web server dies even if the database is the one that's leaked to 60 gigabytes.
The container angle, cgroups v2.
Three gates. Memory.low is protection. The kernel won't reclaim below this unless it's desperate. Memory. .high is throttling. When the croup hits this, allocation stall and the process gets throttled. Memory.max is the hard limit. Hitting this triggers the cgroup OOM killer. That's a separate killer from the global one. A container gets killed at its limit while the host has gigabytes free because the croup OOM killer only looks at the croup's own memory, not the host's. Memory.events tracks high, max, and kill counters monotonically. Memory.pressure gives you PSI. Pressure stall information. With sum and full averages over 10, 60, and 300-second windows. If full is rising, every task in the croup was simultaneously blocked on memory. No useful work was happening at all.
Exit code 137
tells you the process received sigkill-e. That's it. It doesn't distinguish between a croup, OOM kill, kubectl delete pod, or someone running kill-9. You have to check dmz-gore journalfardl-k for the memory croup out of memory colon prefix to confirm it was actually an OOM kill. Without that check, you're flying blind.
Early warning tooling.
EarlyUM is a user space daemon that monitors score and kills processes before the kernel. OOM killer fires based on configured memory and swap thresholds. Systemed-OOM uses croups v2 and PSI. It monitors pressure and kills descendant croups when pressure exceeds thresholds. The advantage of systemed-OOM is that it uses the same metrics the kernel uses to decide when the system is actually suffering, rather than a simple percentage threshold.
And the Prometheus side. What do you actually alert on?
Container memory working set bytes from Kedvisor. That's the metric the OOM killer counts. Anonymous memory plus swap cache minus inactive file pages. It's what matters for OOM. Alert on the slope, not a threshold. Deriv of container memory working set bytes over 30 minutes, sustained above zero for hours. For Go specifically, alert on GoGo routines greater than GoGo routines offset 1 hour times 1.2, more than 20% Go routine growth over an hour. That catches Go routine leaks before they become memory leaks.
So you get paged when the curve starts bending up, not when the process is already dead.
The kill is the last data point. By then you're doing forensics, not monitoring.
Okay, the discipline side. How do you write a regression test for a leak?
For native code, you run ASAN or LSAN in CI with halt on error equals 1. Build with dash F sanitize equals address, run test with asanopeptions equals detectoleaks, equals 1 colon haltonerror equals 1. If a test leaks, the build fails. For Rust, there's a crate called Navian Memcheck published last month. It asserts that memory plateaus after warm-up as a cargo test assertion. It catches reachable, unbounded growth that Valgrind and Leak Sanitizer miss because the memory is still referenced. For other languages, you write a soak test, run the service under production, like load for hours, sample RSS and open file descriptors over time, fail if RSS climbs past a budget or FDs grow without bound.
The prevention patterns.
RAA and smart pointers for C++. Weak references for cycles. Python's weak ref, Rust's weak, Java's weak reference. Bounded caches with eviction. LRU, TTL, something that guarantees the cache, stops growing. Context managers and defer for resource cleanup. Arena allocation, allocate from a big block and free the whole thing at once, which eliminates individual free bugs entirely. And for Go, goliac.verifyTestMain in CI to catch Go routine leaks and tests.
Which brings us to the restart question. Daniel wants us to disagree on this.
I'll start. Just restart it nightly is an admission of defeat. It hides the signal. The next person to touch that service inherits a problem with no graph pointing at it. The container restart cycle. Kubernetes brings it back, RSS drops to baseline, the leak resumes, the cycle repeats. Makes this look like an intermittent crash when it's actually a deterministic leak on a timer. And a leak is also a correctness smell, not only a resource one. Something in your program's logic is wrong. The fact that you can outrun it with a cron job doesn't make it less wrong.
I don't think that's quite right.
Okay, tell me why.
Because correctness isn't the only axis. There are batch workers, scrapers, one-off data pipeline stages where the process runs for 6 hours, leaks 200 megabytes, and then exits. A scheduled restart at hour 4 costs you nothing and prevents the OOM kill entirely. That's not hiding a problem. That's acknowledging that the cost of fixing the leak exceeds the cost of the restart. Some military missile software literally provisions double the expected maximum leak and accepts it. That's an engineering choice, not laziness.
Military missile software has a fixed mission duration. Most of the services I've seen restarted nightly are web servers that someone intends to keep running for years.
Sure. And for a long-lived service, I agree with you. But the absolutist position, all leaks must be fixed, ignores that some leaks are in dependencies you don't control. In C extensions, you can't patch. In allocator behavior, you can't change without a rebuild that requires approval from a team that no longer exists. In those cases, restarting is a legitimate mitigation while you work on the real fix, which might take months.
I'll grant that for dependency leaks. If the bug is in a library you can't upgrade, restarting is a reasonable stopgap. What I object to is restarting as the permanent solution. Because what happens is the restart becomes institutionalized, the original engineer leaves, and 2 years later someone triples the traffic, and the leak outpaces the restart window, and now you've got a production incident at 3 a.m., and nobody knows where the leak is because the graphs have been flat for 2 years thanks to the nightly restart.
That's a process problem, not a technical one. The restart should be documented as a mitigation with a linked bug ticket. If your team doesn't do that, the problem is your team, not the restart.
Fair. But I've never seen a team that actually does that consistently.
Then we agree on the principle, and disagree on whether humans can be trusted to execute it.
I think that's about right. I'm less optimistic about human processes than you are.
You're a donkey who reads kernel source for fun. You are never going to be optimistic about human processes.
That's not wrong.
We ran a VAX cluster in 85 that had a memory leak in the terminal driver. DEC wasn't going to fix it. The patch cycle was 18 months, and we weren't a big enough customer to matter. So we put a cron job in to bounce the terminal controller process every Sunday at 4 a.m. Ran like that for 3 years. Nobody forgot why the cron job was there, because the guy who wrote it, Marty, put a comma in the cron tab that said, DEC terminal driver leaks like a sieve, don't remove. Marty wasn't subtle.
Did anyone ever remove it?
New sysadmin did in 88. Took about 6 hours for the first terminals to lock up. He put it back, wrote his own comment under Marty's. Marty was right. That machine ran until 92 with that cron job. Nobody ever fixed the driver.
So you're on Korn's side.
I'm on the side of knowing which problem you're solving. The problem wasn't fix the terminal driver. The problem was the terminal's lockup. The cron job solved the actual problem. The driver bug was somebody else's problem, and DEC never did fix it. Marty checked the patch notes for 3 years. Nothing.
3 years of patch notes.
He was thorough.
I still think for code you own, you fix the leak.
Sure, if you own it. Marty didn't own the terminal driver. Most people restarting containers tonight don't own the thing that's leaking. They own the outage. Different problem.
And that's the distinction. Own the leak, fix the leak. Don't own the leak, own the mitigation.
I can live with that framing. I still think the mitigation should come with a very loud comment.
Party would agree.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com or email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.